Well, I can just give out these sheets and we can get started. Welcome to our Mary Hytken Dumont Jewish University here at Angers. It's a mouthful, but reminds us of a very wonderful woman, Mary Dumont, for whom this institute is named. Last week we talked about the sea stories or tales of the sea in the Talmud, and this week we are going to be talking about freaks in the Talmud, or supernatural phenomenon within the Talmud, and we'll try to understand that. The part of the Talmud we're looking at, as we mentioned last week, is part of the Agadah, the non-legalistic parts of the Talmud, which are many. Many, many pages of the Talmud are non-legalistic. Some are stories. Next week we'll be talking about rabbinic rivalries, actual stories of actual rabbis. Again, there could be some embellishment, some exaggeration. Last week we talked about stories that were hard to tell what they were. Were they parables or what are they? And this week we'll learn about things that are a little bit beyond nature, and we'll also wonder, are they talking about miracles? Are they talking about something short of a miracle? What exactly are they talking about? But as we approach a passage of the Talmud that makes us wonder, are these rabbis engaged in miracles? Did they experience miracles on sort of a daily basis? Were some of the rabbis of the Talmud miracle workers? As we raise that question, we need to go back to a passage from the Rambam's son, Maimonides' son, and also to look at two new passages, one from the letter about the revival of the dead from Maimonides, from the Rambam, and one, a passage from Nachmanides. So, if someone would start us off with Rabbi Avram, son of the Rambam, and we are being recorded today, so be aware of that. And whoever would like to start first, I'm just going to record them. Debbie, would you start for us?
I'll start. Know that many of these contain both true stories, parables, and dreams. I will refrain from mocking any of the words of the sages. And on the other hand, I will refrain from thinking that the miracles which happened to the sages are as important as either that of the dividing of the Red Sea or the miracle caused by Elisha and Elijah.
Right. So what are the two pitfalls he doesn't want to fall into? Number one, on the one hand, he doesn't want to mock anything. So if we see things tonight that we say, how can that be? What kind of nonsense, Bava Mises, are we talking about? He says, well, I'm not going to engage in that. I don't want to mock anything. It's in the Talmud. It must be important. As we mentioned last week, we may not take it literally, but we certainly want to take it seriously. And the other pitfall he doesn't want to fall into is?
Overemphasizing.
And he's sort of committed to the idea that the Talmud is not equal to
the scripture,
the Tanakh, that the characters in the Torah are not on the same level as the characters of the Talmud. So if we see miracles, he's conflicted because, well, if it says there are miracles, maybe there are miracles. But on the other hand, we know that they cannot be on the same level as Elijah the prophet. They don't claim to be prophets. So we're gonna float somewhere tonight between the miraculous and the natural, between saying that these people are miracle workers or not. We're gonna have to float in that space and try to avoid the mocking, too. All right, what about the Rambam and the Letter of Revival of the Dead? Joe, you're conveniently located right here.
Our efforts are the opposite of the masses. For the masses, people of Torah, whose most beloved thing, because of their foolishness, is to make the Torah a reason, two opposite extremes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And,
the Torah and reason.
Right. Two opposite extremes. And they make everything separate from the rational and say it's a miracle. And they run away from it being a matter of nature. Both the tales of old and in the things they see today are there will be. And we will try to put together the Torah and the rational, and we will put things in the realm of nature as much as we can, except that which is clearly a miracle and it cannot be explained at all. Then we will have to say it is a miracle.
So what do the masses think, just to review? What do the masses think? What do the masses like to say about things they read in the Talmud that could be a miracle? What do they like to say? So whatever it says is a miracle. Even if it doesn't say it's a miracle, they're inclined to think
it's a miracle.
That it is a miracle. And this is how they read the Tanakh as well, right? If something is happening in the Tanakh, you know, okay, that's normal. The classic example we gave last week, Pharaoh's daughter or the princess stretches out her hand or her maidservant to get Moshe. So that's a rational statement. She saw a baby, she felt bad for him, and she took him in. But the rabbis would prefer to see that her arm stretches out 100 feet, and the non-rational rabbis or Jews of the Rambam's day would prefer to see the story as a miracle. The rationalist, Ibn Ezra, some of the Spanish commentators, would prefer not to have miracles. The less miracles, the happier they are, because then there's less of a gap between what their rational mind tells them as the way the world works and the Torah, which they love and they believe in. But the supernaturalists and the masses, the more the Torah is off in the supernatural realm, the happier they are. And if it's less rational, that it's not rational, great. They're not looking for something rational. They're looking for something beyond the rational. Okay. And Nachmanides, of course, has to disagree. He's from a different school of thought. He's not really a philosopher, more of a mystic. He says, Jeff.
He says, from the great famous miracles, a person admits the hidden miracles, which are the foundation of the whole Torah.
In other words, from the fact that there are famous miracles, such as splitting the sea, obviously, therefore you say, oh, that could be, if there could be supernatural miracles that we all agree to, then surely we can deduce there must be other miracles too, right? And that's the foundation of the whole Torah. Go ahead.
So a person does not have a portion in the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu until we believe that all our matters and happenings are all miracles. They have nothing of nature and the way of the world.
In other words, nature is miracle. Everything's a miracle.
And this is what's the relationship of the Rambam's view and the Ramban's view?
That there's both.
Now, what's the relationship? What, how would you describe the relationship between their opposites? opposite views. By the way, Nachmanides, Ramban, the second view, he was always very respectful. The Rambam, he quotes him, even if he says, I disagree or it's wrong, but he always quotes him, discusses him, calls him the rabbi, and they respectfully disagree.
He was more of a mystic.
Constantly. Right.
We have to emphasize that when Ramban says miracles, he means that God's
hands
guides everyone's life and all situations around you. It's not just like
so
that. So
there was
underlying divine plan behind every single thing.
By saying that everything's a miracle, obviously it's putting miracles on a different level.
Then it doesn't mean that everything is splitting with the sea. You need to everything's guided by
divine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that's a great point. But also, naturally, if you equal and you equalize everything, you also lower the things, the peaks as well. Okay, now we are ready for what we've all been waiting for. We called last week the main act, the stories of the Talmud. So we have one case will be a clear case of a freak in the Talmud, and others that are in this realm of the miracle makers of the Talmud. People have supernatural powers. So let's start with the unnatural miracles. Talmud 53b. Debbie, would you read that for us, please?
Our rabbis taught, it once happened that a man's wife died and left the child to be suckled, and he could not afford to pay a wet nurse, whereupon a miracle was performed for him, and his nipples opened like the two nipples of a woman, and he suckled his son.
That is the stupid. This is the story of the freak of the Talmud. Here he is. There you have it. Interesting. Very good. Very good. Excellent. We'll get to that in a minute. All right. So is this a story which is taken at face value? So it could be possible. Any doctors want to comment? Mm-hmm. Right. In other words, why did Dr. Levy says, why did Sarah make a party on the day of the weaning of Isaac? Not just because it's nice to make a weaning party, but that shows everybody that she weaned him. She nursed him. Good. So you're pointing out that it could happen, right? So anyway, so the rabbis comment on it. They actually this turns into a debate. In the Talmud, we don't always find debate. In any legal realm, there's always debate. There's almost no point in mentioning something unless there's debate. Talmud is a record of the debate of rabbis of whatever topic that came up. And it's almost to be sure that if one rabbi says one thing, the other says another, probably as a way of exploring the truth, exploring both sides of an issue. People are seeking truth. People will find different sides of an issue. And because people are different and because the Torah is varied. But here, even in this story, we have a debate about the story as well. Go ahead, please.
Is Sarah bowing to him?
No,
what Joseph observed. What Joseph observed. Come and see how great was this man, that such a miracle was performed on his account. Sarah bowed to him. On the contrary, how lowly was this man, that the order of the creation was changed on his account. Rabbi observed, come and see how difficult are men's wants of being satisfied, that the order of creation had to be altered for him. Rabbi Nachman said, the proof is that miracles do frequently occur, whereas food is rarely created miraculous.
Food or even a person's sustenance or livelihood. In other words, we see miracles all around us, but that someone's livelihood all of a sudden just comes out of nowhere, we don't always see that. All right, so let's go over what happened. There was a debate between who and whom?
Rabbi Yosef and Abaye.
They were, Rabbi Yosef was older, Abaye was younger, but they were contemporaries, of course. And what's Rabbi Yosef's observation about this freak of nature?
Miracle.
It's a miracle, and? Right. He's certainly a great. Right, doesn't say right, but great. If you look, let's see. We'll look in the Hebrew. Right. He's a great man. He's a great man. Gadol. He's a big man. A miracle just for this man. And Abaye. What's Abaye's view? Right. What's wrong with this? Yeah, right. In other words, he's actually very bad. He's in bad shape. Why?
Because he upsets the order of creation.
The order of creation. The order of creation meaning what?
Man is
a man. Right. Man is a man, woman is a woman. Right. And let's see. And then Rabbi Yehuda says that that God could have made a different type of miracle. What was the other miracle he could have made? Milk, or what else? Interesting. Brought the wife back. Brought the wife back. Right. Good idea. Right. But why did he have to do the nursing himself? Because
he
was too poor. So he said, what God didn't do for him was make him rich, make him comfortable. Right? So it's because, no, that's difficult. To help someone make a living, that is murder. That's moving heaven and earth. To change someone's body or the whole creation, that we can do. Give someone a parnassa, that's it. So this is part of it. There are a lot of literature about that the someone making a parnassa is more difficult than the splitting of the sea. Very different.
I would have never thought that.
Right. Yeah. Right, could be. And let's see, yes, okay. Now, so here we have a story, and we have different views as to a story of a freak of nature, a miracle that happened for someone. Everyone seems to agree it's a miracle here. And the question is are miracles that happen to someone good or bad? Right? In the Tanakh, when a miracle happens to someone, do you ask that question? A miracle happens to someone in the Tanakh. Do you ask if they're... Ask if the person, is that good for the person? Right. Can you think of anyone in the Tanakh who had a miracle who was not good? Right. So Bil'am, Balaam or Bil'am. Bil'am was a wicked man. We always call him, the rabbis always refer to him as Bil'am the wicked. He had the miracle. What's the miracle of Bil'am? The miracle of the talking donkey. Very miraculous. It's interesting. It's one. Hey, Suzanne, come on in the funny chair. It's interesting that I would say that is probably one of the most freakish miracles in the entire Chumash of the talking donkey. And yet, Suzanne, there's some chairs that are closer up.
This is good.
Okay. It's one of the most freakish things, and yet the person was wicked. So then we say to her, so our first glance, our first thought would be, well, miracles always happen to good people. But then we say to ourselves, wait a second, there is a wicked person who a miracle happened to. Okay. How about the Egyptians? But in a way, God performed miracles, but they were bad miracles. Anything good? In the 10 plagues, or anything good?
To the Egyptians?
Yes, to the Egyptians. Every time there was a plague, what did they have? What did they need to do?
Oh, they did chew.
Oh, they're true. But they have all these frogs. Okay, the plague is over. Well, how do you end the plague? Right. So they had to ask Moses to pray to end the plague, and then it ended. And there are other Egyptians. There's a seat right next to your husband. Perfect. Okay. Oh, the sheets. Are there more sheets? Oh, we have a couple more. There we go. Oh, good. Great. Okay, good. All right. So we have to think about this. Do miracles happen to good people, bad people? Is changing nature? Is changing nature a good thing, a bad thing, right? We kind of pine, sometimes we pine away for the good old days when we had miracles of splitting the sea. And one time an angel came to Gideon and he said, what happened to the good old days when there were miracles and all that? And here we're saying, no, sometimes miracles are not good. Interesting. Okay. Now, astutely, sure, yes.
When we talk about the miracle of the utensils, the miracle really wasn't for them. You know, whereas, the miracle of Sarah, which is filled by the Isaac, that was for Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So
it was a miracle that was released with the law, but it was not a miracle for them.
Well, right, the donkey was trying to save him from the sword of the angel, but you could argue something like that. I think there is a midrash about something about the leprosy being healed. I have to go back to it, but there may be something about the leprosy being healed so that it was, you know, it was good for them. But it's a good distinction. It's a good question. All right, so now we say, well, wait a second, we've got a problem. Let's turn to Mordechai. Who would like to read that? Julie, do you have a chance?
Mordechai provided. Rabbi Yudan said he went to all the wet nurses and did not find one for Esther, so he himself nursed her. As Rabbi Abahu taught this publicly, the congregation laughed. He said to them, is it not a Mishnah? Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar said, the milk of a male is pure.
So there's actually a legalistic discussion of this question, and they already determined it's not really milk, and it's not really one of the seven liquids that could become impure. So he says, don't laugh at me. That's right. By the way, he was in Caesarea. In Caesarea, it was a Roman city, dangerous place, but he taught there in around the days of Jesus. In any event,
I have a question.
Hold on 1 second. Okay. So, yes, yeah, so what's the question? Yes?
Was Mordechai that poor, or couldn't afford it?
Ah, no, was it a problem that he was poor? What was the problem? So we have a distinction. The first man in the first story, he didn't have a wet nurse because he couldn't afford it. And in Mordechai's case, he couldn't find a wet nurse because, I don't know, for some reason, right? It didn't work. The rabbis say that Moses also wouldn't nurse from anyone. That was his choice. But in any event, what's the question?
The question is, what is the attitude towards such men?
You're cheating me. We have a contradiction. What's the contradiction on the table?
Is it a miracle?
Sort of, but go ahead.
What's the contradiction? What we've read so far. We had a story of a freak of the Talmud. What did the rabbis say about him? Dave, what did they say about him? About the miracle? Either it was. So as a whole, what did the rabbis say? Is that what they say? It was a miracle. It was good. It was good that a miracle happened. What did the rabbi say? Was it bad? There's an argument. Okay. So when it comes to this fellow who was too poor to get an earth, and he has a miracle, he becomes this freakish man. The rabbis debate whether it was good or was bad, whether he was righteous or not. Now ask me a question.
Why don't they ask that?
But when it comes to Mordechai, what does the Midrash say? Oh, right?
That was
the law in the Mishnah, but they tell the story about Mordechai. In what spirit do they tell the story about Mordechai?
It's true.
It's true, and it's also. Excellent. They say it's true, and is it good or bad? It's good. Now, one thing. Dr. Lieberman says not only is it's good. Now, one second. Before we get to Dr. Lieberman's point. So now we have a question. We have a contradiction. One story, it's a debate. Is it good or bad? The other story, it's brought as it's a given. Obviously, one of the great miracles of Mordechai. He was omein. The word omein, he provider, it could have connotations of being a nurse. So he was a nurse of his. Of Esther. That's what he was. He was a provider, he was a nurse of Esther. Now, and that's considered a good thing. So we have a contradiction. Why don't we have a debate here about Mordechai? Why did I just assume Mordechai was good? That was bad. Phil, your answer?
Because he was doing what called Israel, the whole community, okay. Rather than an individual.
So Phil says that when it comes to this fellow, he just does it, he gets it for himself. One rabbi says, for one person to change all of nature for just this guy, is that good or bad? It's bad, he says. But when it comes to Mordechai, by nursing her, it's good for everybody. But we have to refine that a little bit more. It's good for the whole community because Esther is good for the whole community.
Yeah,
but what difference does it make whether she nurses from this one or that one? Why is this miracle have to happen? Why didn't God let her nurse from the next door neighbor? Why did this miracle help the Jews? You're claiming that it helps everybody. Well, it helps her by sustaining this girl. But how does the miracle happening this way, how does that sustain this girl? Okay, it inspired her. As a little girl, she finds out about this. She's very inspired by the miracle. If she views it as a positive miracle, good. So we're going to come to some commentators. We're going to go zero right in on that point in a minute. Now we have another passage that seems to go in this direction. Talmud in Shabbat 32a. Debbie, did you have a chance? Debbie?
Okay. Examined the bridge and then crossed over. Rabbi Yonai acted upon his views, for he said, a man should never stand in a place of danger and say that a miracle will be wrought for him, lest it is not. And if a miracle is wrought for him, it is deducted from his merits.
Now we find out something new. Well, we said that it wasn't good for this man to have a miracle and become this freakish man. Did the rabbi explain why it wasn't good? What did he say?
He said it's not good to what?
To play with Mother Nature, as the commercial or something used to say, right? It's not good to change nature. Here we have another idea that if he's standing on a bridge, and really, as far as the construction is concerned, the bridge is supposed to collapse. But he's Rabbi Yonai, so he makes it through. So what happens in the heavenly books?
He gets a minus.
We cross off, right? How many mitzvahs did he just use up? Right? He just used up
a full tank of mitzvahs. Right? So therefore, he would examine the bridge before he crossed over. Why? Make sure it was sound. Right? What do they call that type of examination? I don't know. Do a survey of the bridge with the
inspection.
Right. Before he crossed it. So he doesn't want to be deducted. So what about Mordechai? Well, Mordechai, he had a miracle happen to him.
He
didn't ask for it. Good. Well, if you cross over a bridge that's shaky, are you asking for it? Could be. Yeah, no problem. Go ahead.
Right. We don't know that.
Even if Esther, right. So not believing. Dr. Lieberman is saying that Esther is different because she's going to save the whole community. But Yoel says, forget it whether she's saving the whole community. She's someone else. He's doing it for her. Yeah, but that man is also doing it for the first freak. I'm just calling him a freak. But my apologies to that man. But the freak, he was also
helping somebody.
So yeah. that may not work.
Well, I sort of follow the first freak.
Oh, okay, right. We don't have a question according to that people. That's true. Now we have a larger, broader story about how rabbis would function, knowing that this fellow is worthy of having a miracle for him.
I may not be. The bridge is falling apart.
We think infrastructure is bad now. You know, you can imagine what it was then, and in Babylonia, or even in Israel,
you need a lot of bridges, a lot of rivers,
right? So. So now we have a larger story about how we navigate the world of miracle workers. No, you would never cross it. If he found it weak, you wouldn't go. He'd only go on a strong bridge. He knew. He did. Right. Interesting. He didn't check out the bridge because he thought that if he went on the bridge, it would collapse. He inspected the bridge because if he crossed the bridge and it was shaky, and he made it to the other side, what would happen? You get deduction. Right. So he didn't want to lose his bank account. That was the problem. It wasn't because he was afraid to fall in. Okay. Now. The Talmud in Tani. Let's see.
Nancy, is it?
Rabbi Huna had wine stored in a certain dilapidated house, and he desired to remove it.
Right, we can't imagine what type of dilapidated
house. He took Rabbi Ada ben Ahava.
Who's a famous miracle worker.
Into that house and kept him occupied with traditional teaching until he had removed it. As soon as he had left the house, it fell in. Rabbi Ada ben Ahava noticed this and was offended because he agreed with the statement of Rabbi
Yanai,
who said, "A man should never stand in a place of danger and declare, 'A miracle will befall me.' Perhaps a miracle will not befall him. And if a miracle does befall him, he suffers thereby a reduction from his merits." Rabbi Hanan said, "This can be inferred from the verse where it is written, 'I am not worthy of all the mercies and of all the truth.'"
Yes, who said that? Who said, "I am not worthy of all the mercies and all the truth"? Was Jacob. Jacob said, "I'm not worthy of all the mercy." So if Jacob could say that, we don't want to be, we don't want to overdo our, what do they say, overstay our... are welcome, right? Over right. So here we see people who they're living. They seem to be living in a world in which if you've got Rav Ada bar Ahava in your pocket, on your side,
it's insurance.
Right, it's insurance. There's no question. There's no question about it. Right, but he knew that the rabbi would not want to be the object of to be used this way, and he used him anyway. The rabbi was annoyed. Right, so. Interesting. Now, the question is, we go back to, who was it? Was it the Rambam or his son? we go back to the Rambam's son, and we say, really? These rabbis could walk into a dilapidated house that by the surveyors, the inspectors' standards is falling, and they can assume for sure that if they're with Rav Azar Bar Hava, they're in good shape? Is this, you know, that the rabbi knew that no matter what he did, no matter what the shape of the bridge was, he's making it to the other side. Are these rabbis miracle workers? So, right, so what are the rationalists going to say? What's the Rambam going to say? No. So, but how would he explain this?
The bridge wasn't that thing.
The Rambam agrees that merits protection, which speaks about the
merit of protection. Let's see. We have an expert on the morning rules. So I'm not going to argue with that. I will mention, though, that he didn't like the idea that the mezuzah protects you, that mitzvahs, an object of a mitzvah protecting.
When he talks about a building standing,
that's the Rambam believes, and feel free to chime in, that we live in two worlds. Normal people can't bank on their mitzvahs or prayers or to save them. And extremely righteous people, they live like Moses, where like these people, where everything operates according to plan. So yes, so he could explain that these people lived on a different plane, and that's it. But still, I still wonder the spirit of the Rambam's son that says, you know, if you believe everything literally in the Talmud, you must be some kind of a fool. If you don't believe it at all, you're a heretic. So I would suspect that they would try to see this as, you know, not sort of like a voodoo type of situation where, you know, the rabbi could walk in and say, hold up that wall. And then, you know, even though there are stories where the rabbi said, make the wall go in, make the wall go out, he would probably try to tone down, say that there's an element of exaggeration being used. There's no question. The rabbis admit that there's an element of exaggeration in certain passages that they have. So I would think they would go in that direction. Whereas for the masses, or even for the Ramban, perhaps he's not the best example because there's an element of rationality with Ramban as well. But for many pietists, many Jews today who read the Talmud very literally, these people are miracle workers, very similar to Elijah the prophet. Not a big difference, right? Not a big difference. Yes. Comments. Yes.
That's.
I was going to say, I'm not saying this is what I would say, but even if you want to say that the parable is not a parable in heaven, as you know, as stated, you know, you could say that the people writing, you know, whatever people down in these stories, should believe them.
Okay. Right, so you want to look at sort of from the point of view of the edit, right? In other words, right. So, well, that's a point of view. I think the Rambam's son, just in his general comments about Agadah, about this type of material in the Talmud, is claiming that even though the stories look like they're these miracle stories, not everything is what it looks like. But it's certainly reasonable to believe that an ancient person told this story, and these stories were told about these people because that's what happened. We know today, for instance, that sometimes people tell supernatural stories about great people. If you speak to people who are a little closer, they'll say there's an element of exaggeration. But still, as they say, they don't tell stories like that about me or you. Right? So there's some relationship between the truth and even an exaggerated story. Yes?
Well, certainly the first story where the man's wife dies. Mm-hmm. That could have been just a commonly told story because they don't pinpoint it on the person. Mm-hmm. And then the rabbis take that story and then elaborate on the nature of miracles. So really, the story itself is not a point at all. It's more the discussion about if this would have happened, whether it happened or not. We have discussed what we derive from that. So we followed the story in order to elaborate a philosophical point.
Right. As a matter of fact, it could be that this person was not even Jewish. It could be that this legend was not even a Jewish legend. It could be a local legend. And they're saying, how do we examine and understand that local legend, which may or may not have happened even? Right. But we definitely notice that the man has no standing. He's just a man. It's not told of a pious man or a chassid. Many stories are told of a chassid echad, one particular pious man. Here it doesn't say. Good. One more sort of contradictory point. I guess we could have brought this in before, but let's just read one more passage from this Midrash Rabbah, page 3 at the top. Let's see. Larissa, would you read that for us, please?
Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel said, "How great is the love of Israel for the Holy One, blessed be He. Change the order of Genesis for their good, for He brought down for them bread from heaven and brought dew from the ground, as it says, and the falling of the dew came up."
That's the irony. Bread usually comes from the dew. It came from the dew. Usually comes from the heaven, and at this time it came up. So
once again, now we have this problem on a national level. That what for the entire Jewish people, it seems that the miracle was a great thing, right? And the more nature changes, the better. So we have all these problems. So some of you have suggested certain answers. Let's take a look at a couple of different answers. The Yafei Toar is a commentary on the Midrash. And Esther, would you read that for us, please?
But over there, he could have made a living higher with earth. That is why the change was viewed as a flaw. But the manna was the only way to provide the bread in the desert. Also, God wanted to show them His miracle.
Okay, so we have two answers. What's the difference between the man from heaven and the wet nurse?
There's a way that He could have provided the wet nurse, but He
Right, a way that they could have provided for the freak in a way that would not have changed nature. Whereas, you're trying to feed an army in the desert, then how many options do you have? A zero. So, right. Yes. Right. So it could be that for the whole community, it's different than an individual. We'll see that answer in a second. And also, the second answer is not fully fleshed out, but something to the effect that He wanted to show them His miracles. In other words, yes.
Sadia Gomes will say that God's miracles are in the early period to establish the religion.
Excellent.
So we don't need that because the religion is already established, but they need it.
Very good. Rabbi Yol says something which is, you can hear echoes of it in that Ramban that we quoted before, that from the famous miracles, one can learn about God's hand in life and perhaps about modern miracles. Good. Now, then we have the Zera Yitzchak commentary to Shabbat. It says the answer is that here the change was in his body and there was outside the body. Again, where was the change in the body? The wet nurse. And where was the change outside the body? The man. So what difference does it make? What difference does that make? Well, that could be different. That's the next answer.
Outside the body.
Because if it's inside the, if it's a change in the body, then it's a change
of nature,
right? Whereas, in a very concrete sort of way, okay. Or here it's for the individual and there for the masses. That's the answer we've heard here from several of you. That it's for the individual and there for the masses. Again, what difference does that make? One second. Let's use the logic we had before. What's the there were two problems with changing nature. Problem number one. Oh, problem one I just said.
Changing nature.
Right. Problem number two. Using up merits. So in terms of changing nature, does it matter if it's for an individual or for a community?
Yeah.
Maybe you could say that for the entire community, you could change nature. For one guy to change nature, how dare he? Could be. And then for the other reason, if doing a miracle, changing nature, brings you demerit. So if it's at one person, then what happens to that person? He's in big trouble. If it happens to the entire community, right? No, right, what demerits? Maybe one person can lose a demerit. Everyone will lose, you know, a smidgen of a demerit. Right. So that could be the answer. Okay. And then we have Yosef Chaim of Baghdad. Not many rabbis wrote on the Agadah. I was telling Julie, our president, that I've been sort of obsessing over this class because there aren't that many commentators on the Agadah. There are some, as you see, but they're harder to find. Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad lived a couple hundred years ago. He was one of the few who wrote an extensive commentary on Agadah, and he says a couple of interesting things. Who wants to read that for us? I'm going to sit over here. And David, want to read that? Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad.
Okay, Mordechai did so out of wealth, and his fellow out of poverty.
So we talked about that, right? That right? If he's doing it out of poverty, that shows that what? It's hard to say that. Oh wow, the guy really loves this guy, because right? Oh, why is it? Why is that? Well, anyway, maybe we shouldn't get into that. Okay, moving along.
Or Mordechai is trying to preserve Esther's low profile, so as to save the Jews later.
Yeah, this is the piece that I wanted to add to Phil's point. What do you mean that Esther was for the benefit of the entire community? Esther was for the benefit of the entire community. Right, that would imply she knew that it was going to happen. But also, having him nurse her helps this Esther story because it helps preserve her low profile. What do you mean by her low profile?
People wouldn't see her condition.
No. Where she was from. Well, it was very important to Mordechai and his whole plan, and that was something he sort of was prescient about, that it's good for no one to know where she's from. The more people start being her nurse and her nanny and her godmother and all that, too much knowledge. And she should just be this random person from nowhere.
So Mordechai was
a prophet? Well, some say he was Malach. The Midrash says that he was a prophet.
Prescient.
Right, prescient, I would say. A prophet, that's a Midrashic idea. And again, how do we take that? Was he truly a prophet or not? The debate.
Okay.
I'm sorry about the lack of other hand. But he says, let's say you wake up in the morning and you have no money and then all of a sudden, you don't have any water and then all of a sudden there's a leak in your neighbor's, in the entire water system in the neighborhood and it waters your lawn. So you didn't have time to water your lawn, so it's good for you. Did you have to pray for that to happen? Who else could have prayed for it? Your neighbor, somebody else. But when you have a person in this particular situation, doesn't have a wife and doesn't have a wet nurse and can't afford it, then how many people are praying that he could nurse his child? What? Nobody. Right? So it's totally on his own merit. This is a Hasidic type of thought. This is a Sephardic rabbi, but he's also mystical. If there are a bunch of rabbis praying for you and you get answered, that's one thing. But if no one else in the world is making such a prayer, you must be a special kind of a guy. Go ahead.
The Sefer
HaGilgulim. Now, just to show you how far afield some of the commentators on Agadah, on these stories of Talmud go, they say, well, there's a book about who is a transmigration of whose soul. In other words, you have two people in the Bible, you say, oh, this one, he's a transmigration of the other one's soul. And so they say, well, when Rebbe, the man who wrote the Mishnah, was born, they wanted to kill the Jews. But he hung out with some Roman governoress, and she held the two babies, her son and the other son, and the other son turned out to be the emperor. So the rabbi who wrote the Mishnah was very close with the emperor, Antoninus, or somebody, and that's how it all happened. And since they were holding them, maybe it's like the nurse. So this fellow, he really, you know how this, he's really a Gilgal. He's a a reincarnation of this other person. Just an example of how creative, how mystical some people try to get with these passages. Moving along to Chashuk Echemet, a lot of people are having a lot of fun these days with Rabbi Zilberstein and his fun things that he says. So he says the following. Charles, would you read that for us?
A miracle happened to a controversial man in town. Does that
happen? Some people say that he was a miracle worker. Some people say he's a fraud. Some people say he's a crook. And then a miracle happens and he's found.
Does that prove he is a righteous man?
That's the question that Rabbi Zilberstein was asking.
We find miracles happen to the Egyptians,
so
Rabbi.
That's where the references have to be double-checked, where it's some sort of miracle with Egyptian leprosy.
Rabbi Chaim Voloshin believed miracles about the Vilna Gaon, but not various Hasidic rabbis. Why?
You see,
the
they were Hasidic and Mizrahi. So the Hasidim told stories about miracles of their rabbis. Rabbi Chaim Voloshin, as a starch anti-Hasidic Mizrahi, never believed any of the stories. He wasn't impressed by any of the stories in miracles. Or they told him stories of his own rabbi. He said, oh, it's wonderful. And they said, wait a second. If you believe in miracles, don't believe in miracles. The answer is...
Why? If you tell me a miracle happened to one known to be pious, we know why it happened. But if someone had a miracle, we don't know if it is merit or not.
Is that right? If someone else has a random person, and you say, it's a Hasidic rabbi, but in those days, maybe the old rabbis were never necessarily so pious, learning, so then, if they had a miracle, then we could say that they had a miracle. Allah, who's a miracle?
Nature.
Just think back here. So let me back here. Everyone wants to read over here. Playing with Mother Nature. This is an extreme case of playing with Mother Nature. Extreme case of miracle working. Let's take a look.
Playing with Mother Nature, Sanhedrin 65b. Rava said, if the righteous desired it, they could by living a life of absolute purity, be creators, for it is written, but your iniquities have distinguished between me and you.
Because if not for our sins, we'd be the same as God. More or less. That's what the verse said. Go on.
Rabbah created a man and sent him to Arzira.
Rabbi Zira.
Rabbi Zira. Rabbi Zira spoke to him, but received no answer. Thereupon he said unto him, thou art a creature of the magicians. Return to thy dust.
Some people say it's not a magician, but you were created by one of my friends, one of our colleagues. No good. Go ahead.
Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Oshahaya spent every Sabbath Eve in studying the Book of Creation.
This is a book which
purports to have come out in the Middle Ages, but we don't know if he had the original book or not, but mystical book. Go ahead.
By means of which they created a third grown calf and ate it.
What's the third grown? Well, there are many opinions, either that it was a certain age that was very tasty, or that other opinions are that it was tilta, that it was three times as fat, or something like that. But anyway, they created something very tasty. So
this takes us back to the question we have here. If we wonder whether the rabbis of the Talmud were miracle workers, this seems to close the case. Right? I mean, here that's the ultimate. If we talk about being God and man being partners in creation, this is taking that idea to an extreme that people could create people. We brought this up in connection with the question of, can a person clone someone? Well, the rabbis don't have a problem with the cloning as an act of creation. They say, no, that people are capable of that. Maybe not everybody. But in any event, the Ben Yehoyada, in a Talmudic fashion, Ben Yehoyada, the commentary from Baghdad, he says, really, there's a debate here. One rabbi made this creature. The other rabbi said, go back to the dust. So we have a debate. What's the debate? Right? He says, if he can't speak, he's no good. So the mystic Rabbi Ben Yehoyada says, the way he created him was mystical names of God. But you have to put them in the right order. He must have put it in the wrong order. It was a malfunction. He can't speak. This is not a creation. You have not been a partner with God in creation. You did not create man. You created a dud, a golem, another Gornish. Right? We know that there's a story like this of the golem from the Maral of Prague a few hundred years ago that he created something similar. Also couldn't particularly talk. Whether it happened, who knows? In any event, so there's a debate whether he did it right. Reb Zera wasn't opposed to it. He just thought he did it wrong. So this is his way of looking at it. So when you read the Talmud, people like Rava, they do not claim to be miracle workers. That doesn't seem to be their bread and butter activity. They're more misnagdish than Hasidish. They seem more engaged in law. Rava is on almost every page of the Talmud, meaning that he has thousands of debates about minute points that many of you would find, you know, picayune or who knows what. That's what they spend most of their time doing. And yet here they emerge as these great miracle workers of some sort, unless there's a more metaphoric reading to it. So that's our major discussion on tampering with Mother Nature, freaks of nature, and the question as to whether the rabbis were miracle workers or not. But one more that also touches on this point, and this is a more elaborate story than the others. And let's take a look at that. There were so many, had a lot of trouble choosing the stories for tonight. Let's see, we could move on to something else, but this is so much fun. Hold on, I just have to decide what to do. Let's see here. Let's see. All right, maybe I'll just tell you briefly about the other story. But let's stay on this topic of more tampering with nature, and we're going to see a very extreme case. It's so extreme, I had to edit it. I couldn't tell you the whole story. Okay, moving along. Tani 23b. Tani in general about rain, a tractate about famine and rain, and a lot of stories about miracles and people who pray. So let's take a look at this. Suzanne, even though you're hiding all the way back there, would you read for us?
Again, Rav Mamman moved off into a tent in his rooftop, and he complained, "The rich members of the family of my father-in-law are annoying me." The latter exclaimed, "May they become poor." And they became poor. Later on, Rav Mani complained, "They press me for support." And Rav Isaac explained, "Let them become rich." And they became rich. On another occasion, he complained, "My wife is no longer acceptable to me." So Rav Isaac thereupon asked, "What is her name?" He said, "Hannah." Whereupon Rav Isaac exclaimed, "May Hannah become beautiful." And she became beautiful. He then complained, "She's too domineering over me." So, if that is so, let her... Whereupon Rav Isaac exclaimed, "If that is so, let Hannah revert to her former ugliness." So she became ugly once again. Two disciples used to attend the discourses of Rav Isaac ben Elishab, and they said to him, "Master, pray that we may become very wise." He replied, "Once I had the power to do this, but now I sent the power away."
Okay. Now, so this is a person with freakish powers. Everything he says comes to be. His name is Rav Yitzchak Ben Elyashiv. You would expect that. Oh, so he must be a very famous rabbi, right? He must be one of the big rabbis that we hear. No, we don't hear much about him. I give you a little background here on the next page, on page 5. It mentions that one time, on the one hand, it says that when he died, 70 thresholds of houses collapsed because they were only standing because he was alive. They say that about some other rabbis too. Some interpret a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, Maaser Sheni, to mean that Rabbi Yonah, one of the big rabbis of the Jerusalem Talmud, laughed at Rabbi Yitzchak. He said a certain halachic opinion, a legal opinion, and the other rabbi thought it was so silly, he actually laughed at him, which is not totally unusual, as we'll learn next week in our rivalry of rabbis class, but it could be that he had somewhat of a diminished status, and we'll see in a minute that, I'm sorry, I cut out that story. There, a story. The next story that's told is that one of the rabbis was always studying. One of the big rabbis was always studying with this Rabbi Yitzchak Ben Yashiv, the miracle worker. And then all of a sudden he switched to a different yeshiva. They said, "Why are you here?" He says, "The man has no mercy on his children. I can't stay with him." So he's criticized for not having mercy on his children, as we'll see in a moment. But first, we want to focus on a couple of things. In this story, what's new here, different than the other stories we had before? done by the rabbi, as opposed to.
As opposed to just occurring.
Occurring by God doing it, he's doing it. And you say it's bad. Why don't you elaborate on that? If you're not comfortable with it, I want you to spell it out. There, we're going to find a commentator who is also not comfortable with it. But spell it out. What's the problem?
There was a goal. There were almost
Things are it's more witchcraft. Right. I sometimes feel this way when often ask questions to big rabbis and things like that. And sometimes the big rabbi doesn't have time to get into the details. So I'm like, oh, someone's dying and there's a, and it's almost like, well, you're going to give me some time to get the case across. And here it's like the impatient rabbi. You have a problem? Let him change. So there's that. What else is different about this story than the story of the freak? The one who's asking for By the way, Hasidic Jews could be very comfortable with a part of, not the whole story, but part of it, because there's the idea that you go to the Rebbe to solve very mundane problems. These are not religious problems, but right. What else? How about the pace of it? It's
even is praying for it. Let there be made of it. There's no praying in the other one.
Oh, right. Well, that could make it better, right? At least he's not...
Okay, good. And then he says, oh, that power, I don't have it. I sent it away. So then you say, what's going on here? This guy seems like he really loves these miracles. So...
So maybe it's an acknowledgement, but
it's no good anymore.
Yeah, go ahead.
In other words,
this is not a story of a rabbi who. Right. So now what are you saying? What is he saying?
Good.
And who learns from the parable?
The rabbi himself.
He grows in the story.
He grows. He comes to realize there's nothing doing. Now. Oh, good. The miracle.
Right.
You change the whole world for your prayer, and for this guy's problem, and then it hasn't even solved anything.
You have to change it all over again.
So the problem is that he sent it away, it wasn't taken away from him.
Right. Well, we'll see. So there are different views of it. Let's take a look. What does it mean that he sent it away?
Yes.
Also,
the original state was beneficial to begin with.
Good. And maybe the person comes back as a changed person.
Let's just read some of these commentaries. What does it mean to send it away? Rashi. Is it? Rashi on the bottom of page 4. In italics on the bottom of the first.
Oh, Rashi, now my prayer is not accepted so much.
Now, you think I can just pray for anything? It doesn't work anymore. Somehow my prayers are not working anymore. Esther.
Rabbeinu Gershom, Rashi's predecessor. Page 4, bottom of the italics.
But I accept it on myself, not to my maker.
There's a new idea, which is found later when he condemns his son for making a miracle. He says, why are you bothering your maker? So the Rabbi Yehuda Gershom says, he decided not to bother his maker anymore. What does that mean, not to bother your maker?
Miracles,
don't ask for miracles. It's bothering the maker. So this is a third idea. It's not just a changing nature that God likes nature. Don't mess with Mother Nature, but rather you're bothering God to change everything the way it ever was. Perhaps ingratitude.
Maybe that's how he did these miracles. Does that indicate that these things change by praying instead of just by him doing it? When it says, I'll accept it on myself not to bother my maker, is that what it means?
Yes, right. This is a story not so much of a miracle maker, but in some way of a prayer macher. You know, right. Well, you know, this tractate is very much filled with Hanina ben Dosa, who's on our next page, if we have time. People who were Choni Hamaga, the circle maker, people who are experts at prayer. All right. Then we go on to
the other Marsha.
This may explain the attitude toward his son's miracle.
Right, that when later his son does a miracle, he says, what? You bothered God for that? And he curses him. So that fits with that. Go ahead.
Spasa
MS. I couldn't find it, but someone quoted it.
He sent it away because to give out wisdom is dangerous.
What does that mean? To give out wisdom, he says, no, wisdom, that you want something about your family, fine. You want wisdom, not giving it. Why? Ah, good. Good wisdom comes from experience. What else?
So
maybe you need to be worthy, right? Who's the classic person who got wisdom and who was worthy of wisdom and who's Shlomo, King Solomon? And why would, and based on that, why would you say it's dangerous to have wisdom? You could. What about the Solomon story? How did that work out?
Good man.
Good
man. Maybe the three levels of knowledge. You said he didn't look up and he said it went fast and just did the miracle. But there was no understanding. So this may have been, if you're given an act, a position, you may learn a fact without understanding the basis and create ill rather than good. Because it doesn't have all levels, the deeper levels of understanding.
Oh, you mean Chachma Bina Vadas, the three in other words, not just knowledge, but also understanding. Right. In other words, the story folds back on itself. Not only, I'm not going to give you wisdom, I didn't have wisdom when I just foolishly used my powers. I was acting like a youth who had all these powers, but didn't know how to use them. Yeah. Sorry? Nadav Navio, good. Interesting. Yeah, of course, Solomon also, he said, oh, Torah says not to have many wives because it says you shouldn't turn your heart away. I'm a smart guy. I'll have many wives, but they won't turn my heart away. He was trying to outsmart the Torah, so that's a problem. All right, and now back to the local folks over here.
Here we go with the Gilgal again, with the mysticism, right? He says, you think that some of us may be a Gilgal, a reincarnation of someone else, but not that simple. If you really do a good job, you know, if not been a breath, something that you do a tikkun to fix your soul, then at some point you may get to like 30, 40, 50, 60 years old, and you're done. You fix that previous soul. And then where it goes? It's done. Then you got a different one. So you said, I have a different soul now. I can't help you. So, very sensible. Okay, go ahead. I still read the Benyamin that I usually define other more rational things, but I thought I'd share that with you. And then someone quoted a sefer, Mechir Yayin, which I think is written by the Ramah, the author of the Ashkenazic quoted as well. So,
God made a miracle just to fulfill his lust, but rather the robot trained him. He said, what is her name? Chana. She was jealous.
I remember Chana had a problem. Although we loved Chana, she was great. In some ways, her basic problem was that she was jealous of the other woman who had children. Right. She said, oh, that's what we're all about. It's jealousy. Now, I'm not sure if this, I think it could be read that who's jealous in this case? Of what? get back to it, didn't you?
You are jealous. Work on it. You can return her to the way she was. Meaning he learns to not be jealous of other men.
In other words, why is there always a problem? Because he couldn't be in love with his wife. You know what the problem was? He was looking at other people's wives, or he was looking at other places. But so he taught him to appreciate her. So it's a didactic. So look at the difference. I mean, you have this Gilgul interpretation, right? It's a mystical, magical worker. And then my powers ran out, right? That's the mystical read on this book, on this story. And then the more rational one, in which this is a mentor training someone, it is a disgusting story. You're not the kind of questions you should be asking. It's not right. He mentors him, he trains him. And what's he doing? That was me. I lost my power. My power went away. Good. Well, wisdom comes in my next class, right? Good. So that's right. The other thing is that the way the rabbis tell it, the next part of the Talmud, the rabbi continues to do strange things, including curses his son for doing a miracle, and then the part I edited out is this weird story about his daughter. But anyway, look at the central country. The best part is our second grade time when the parts get this. But anyway, Samuel Post, I don't know what to call it, somebody wrote on Dot, it's a very good website online, it's based on a journal that you took from Dot, you know.
It seems that this is a satirical account of the power of speech found in these rabbis. The dialogue is a parody, and it says something of the limits of power. The power of speech knows no limits, and therefore has no meaning. The power so beautiful when it comes to bringing rain becomes ugly and laughable.
But again,
this chapter is mostly talking about time, fast days, rain, right now in the time of year, it's not rain, people start fasting. And then they're changing, the rabbi goes like,
there is a contrast between the frivolous request he got and the one about wisdom, but he decided that it became a joke in the marketplace and he needed to stop.
Right.
So the whole story is satire. So you have a story. It's not different than last week. It's not, we're not making metaphors of a story. It's satire. We're telling the story in such a wonderful way. I saw online on YouTube, there was it seems really not a sophisticated master's in town, okay? So he's just coming to give me a class, and he's just like, he just made a story out of a story. That's what a lot of people would do. And therefore, by the way, there's in there in certain strange, sexist kind of views, and here's someone, not only this modern person on this website, Dot, but also this, perhaps it's the one, now, whoever it is, this other book, what was it called? Sifrim and Queen Mary, it's a book, it's a commentary on Esther, saying that there's much more to this. It's actually, it's a rabbi mentoring this history. That kind of brings us out of time. I'll just briefly tell you this other story. Named my father, Russell Winwood, like to tell the following story. There was a rabbi, there was a place, on page 6, there was a place where there was a lizard. Remember last week, what are lizards? What are lizards? They remind us of which creature in the Bible? There was a place where the snake, what's the snake represent? Evil desire, temptation. The snake was bothering everybody, right? Nobody could learn that anything. Everybody was so distracted by society, by who knows what. So they told this to a Chanina Ben Dosa, the great scientist who could pray for anything. He says, where is the hole? He puts his foot in the hole, and the lizard came out and bit him, and who died?
The lizard.
So they say, woe is unto unto a man who meets a lizard, and woe is unto a lizard who meets then Joseph. And the story comes in three versions, and my mother like to say that what does it mean? That the rabbi showed them that you could somehow confront these evil forces, they could be combated with his prayers. He said, the other version is he was saying to him yesterday, he didn't notice that the snake bit him, and a river developed below him, representing Torah, the Torah saved him, and his prayers, and we are learning time we can confront evil. Yes, and it's interesting, he put his heel on it, doesn't do that symbol. Put his heel, what does heels have to do with the story? Heel? The snake was cursed that you will be crushed on the heel by the man. So that page 7, as it says, you shall crush his heel. So usually when the sinner comes to sinners, the snake bites your heel. When it comes to the righteous, you can step on the heel. So if we ask ourselves, why would the rabbis want to attribute miracles to the early rabbis of the Talmud?
Show their piety.
Show their piety.
They
want to abandon the Jews. Well, that is not abandon the Jews. Some people would say that right. In other words, I met someone once who said, why are you so attracted to Buddhism and all kinds of things? He says, because they can do miracles. You guys lost your powers. Right? That's it. So the rabbis of the time would say, not we have rabbis who, we call rabbis who, they often say, we don't have the same power, we pray all day, nothing happens, but the early rabbis, let me tell you a story about them, and what happened. So they're trying to undo that. Yes.
Maybe they're trying to give hope to people who really have no hope, or very little hope, and say, there are things beyond secular, beyond earthly, that you don't understand, we don't understand, that they can happen.
Right.
The failure to believe that there could be a miracle or that it could
just
be a
miracle. It's possible.
It could be a prayer. Right. It kind of takes a lot of the punch out of prayer and piety. Why would the Rambam in the Middle Ages not want to have miracle makers in his Talmud?
Rambam?
The Rambam, my mind is, he does not want. He's going to, if he can get away with interpreting any of these stories, in a way, we don't have all those interpretations. I don't know what to say about this. He started writing a commentary on Haggadah, but he says he has one. We have one page of it. Why was he drawn to not interpret a miracle as a miracle? Even it says in the paper, this is a miracle. Even the Rambam, in the commentary we read, the last rabbi in the last page, he sort of took the miracle part out of it. It becomes a lesson of a teacher.
You think he was trying to, the Jews in those days were going to Greek thought, and he was trying to synthesize Aristotle, Moses, and say, there is a lot, it's ours. Aristotle didn't start this. This is Moses. And the more you get it away from logic, these were people who were extremely intellectual, and he was trying to bring them back from escaping into Greek thought.
So,
in a rational era, you're trying to take all the miracles out of the Talmud. Where people felt they were losing some of their power or their impressive stature as religious figures, then you want to bring the miracles back. And what's beautiful is these stories are here for both camps. They're for both camps. The mystics got various souls migrating in and out of these various bodies, and the naturalists, they see a man methodically teaching his student a lesson about the limitations of speech and power and prophecy. So this is a little different this week. Well, this week we're not talking about metaphors per se, but one of the posters here, one of the commentators, modern author, sees it as satire and
So it's a different way of reading the Talmud. And also, when we saw the miracles, not every rabbi in town was impressed. Some said there are limits to miracles, that perhaps not good to have miracles, but we don't need to pine away for the good old days when we had miracles. There's something negative about miracles as well. In any event, that's our lesson tonight. Our official answer to where people go, but if anyone wants, excuse me, wants to see the questions, that's great. Next week, we'll be discussing the rivalries of the rabbis, stories, and then the rabbi's rendezvous with rulers, a lot of different interesting stories, including one we alluded to tonight, and Elijah's tales, lots of, I'll take some good Elijah's tales to share with you for a lot of the new topics. So join us.
What are you now?
Thank you.